the weekend college then was your first experience with a rethinking of course design and teaching philosophies and everything. And
right.
that appealed to your sensibility of...
Oh,
yeah.
Yes, I loved it. And of course, the other thing that was very exciting is that, it was a shared enterprise with colleagues. We were all doing it. We were creating this new thing. We were talking about teaching and we were... And it was absolutely wonderful to teach adults. That actually was what made the success of Weekend College, I think. I mean, obviously there was a lot of adventurous spirit. And also, of course, it wasn't just what a wonderful idea. The reason Weekend College was created is out of necessity. The number of undergraduates coming to a women's college had really dropped, just as the number of people entering religious communities, in the late 60s, was just a total and fairly rapid change in the sense of women's choices and women's lives. And that affected enrollments at Mundelein as well as, people choosing a religious community as a vocation. So by 74, it was clear we needed to address how to have students.
And were there men and women, or just women on Weekend College?
There were men and women, although the number of men was small. There were a lot of discussions about how can you be a women's college and admit men. And the decision, I think, that was reached was, a women's college means you focus, you have programs and you address educational needs of women, and if men find that they want to benefit from these educational programs, they're welcome. But you're not going to design programs for men.
So did men start, once Weekend College started, was that when Mundelein started accepting men in the weekday programs too? Or was
I don't know the details about accepting in the weekday. There was a kind of allowing you to attend classes. And there was probably some detail about how we finessed that notion of men being in the programs and then when they could take degrees. And I think finally in the end, even in the day they could be in the day program. And the ultimate point was the programs and the education is created and designed and maintained for women, and if men benefit from that, that's fine. But we do not have any obligation to address issues or claims that men might have for what they want.
Okay, that makes sense.
And so we don't have to have sports teams, and we don't have to address. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of the complaints I think they had was we didn't have enough bathrooms for men. And that's actually a change with Loyola. I don't know if you know the skyscraper building, but there's a small toilet and sink inside the sort of closet or storage room on every floor. It's a single thing. And then there's the stalls in the bathroom. And so what happened was that single toilet became the men's toilet on every floor, and the women had the larger stalls.
Okay.
But now that Loyola's there, they alternate. The stalls are men's bathroom on one floor, women's on another,
okay.
So that men now have more facilities in the skyscraper building than they did. Of course, there are more men in the building, too. So. It was, and we didn't talk a lot about it, but there was that sense of how can you be a women's college and have men students, and that was pretty much the way it was resolved.
Yeah. Okay. Now, at the Weekend College, was that the same program as the contractual life experience program, or was
it?
That was different.
Yeah.
Okay.
And actually, I was away for this. The history of Mundelein is one of necessity forcing invention on us all the time. So in the 60s, they had this institutional analysis and sort of had a whole transformation of the understanding of women's education. It still was building out of a tradition at Mundelein, which was to educate women for economic responsibilities and independence, along with marriage. So there was always this sort of practical element of education at Mundelein. It wasn't a finishing school, but it was a liberal arts college. But the idea was, you know, women should be prepared to take care of themselves, even though it was also true that they should marry and have families, and that was encouraged, there were courses on marriage. So it was an interesting juxtaposition of these two values from the beginning. And in the 60s, this sort of took on a new form. In some ways, the emphasis on liberal arts and personal fulfillment and education for its own sake was highlighted, and it's sort of more of an elite college. But there was also this social commitment and a sense of citizenship and public responsibility and all, even if not so much for careers.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a new way of understanding the foundational tradition. Anyway, that also continued in Weekend College when we had people who were working, who now were students.
Okay.
So that was another way in which the Weekend College made us aware of our tradition in an interesting way. But anyway, I was talking about
the
crisis.
Life, yeah. We started out with the life experience credits.
Oh yeah, that.
Yeah.
How to get around
right.
back to that. Okay. The reason I was talking about the 60s is because I was away, but in 69, there was this big event at Mundelein called the Conference on Curriculum.
Okay.
And the basic studies program had been put in like in 66 or 64 for the whole transformation of Mundelein. And it went out in 69. The students hated it. They hated having all of this core curriculum controlled and being told what to do. And they wanted to make their own choices and design their own studies. And
okay.
So the Conference on Curriculum eliminated the core and left it as much more of a series of electives that students could choose. Students were much more involved in designing their own program.
Okay.
And out of that came the most independent was the contract degree. But you
okay.
could really, it was, originally it was called Mandela, that it was sort of an independent study program within the college for students who really wanted to be creative.
And was it for younger people too then?
Yes,
or
it was
for
anybody.
Everyone? Okay.
And, but for younger people it was more, you know, what we would now call service learning or internships and
okay.
combinations of courses that were not the standard major, but, you know, putting together your own interests. Interdisciplinary studies, which are now sort of organized, but
mm-hmm.
at that time students were sort of inventing it. And there weren't too many that wanted to be that independent, but if they wanted
but
to
that
be,
was
they
an
could
option.
Be. So
okay.
that was an option. And then much more freedom in putting together your major or your core courses was available for everybody. And when Weekend College came, it was even clearer that all these programs about credit for life learning and being assessed on what you had learned in non-academic settings to see if it was the equivalent of what you were learning in courses,
okay.
which was a kind of reverse of the internship. You know, if you were a young student, you could go and learn in the field. But if you were an older student who had already worked in an area, could you demonstrate your knowledge of, you know, marketing or accounting or social, you know, like politics, if you were in the League of Women Voters
mm-hmm.
or if you were involved in or if you were in Bible study groups in your parish church, you know, did you have the equivalent of the introductory course in the New Testament or something?
Mm-hmm.
So we had to figure out all kinds of ways to evaluate whether or not people had the equivalent of the formal education through other ways of learning. And that became the contract degree. People who wanted to demonstrate that they had acquired this learning in a lot of different ways. And then with a faculty committee, they would also contract to demonstrate their intellectual abilities and the equivalency of what would be a major field of study.
Okay.
And do a project that would demonstrate that they had the skills that we would expect from a student who did a history major or whatever major they did. Now, I was very in favor of that. It seemed to me to be like a return to the medieval notion of, you know, the faculty determining whether or not a person had the, had acquired the skills. And instead of being course by course, it was a faculty committee who had to look over the portfolio, interview, and examine the student and say, yes, this student has the intellectual abilities that we expect a college graduate to have.
And was it the same committee for every student?
No, it was a different
separate
committee. But then, and then it got into issues about quality control and residency hours. And, you know, finally, I think it was killed because, you know, the bureaucracy sort of took mm-hmm. over. And by the 80s, this insight that, you know, the sort of root of education was faculty and the students, and the faculty deciding that a student had achieved the appropriate goals, which is usually done through all these accumulated hours and individual courses from all these faculty. But still, the heart of the matter is faculty are deciding that students have acquired the requisite knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So why can't we do it in this sort of more direct form? But I think it was under Mary Murphy, she had to.
It just sort of, it fell by the wayside.
Well, and it was because other administrators came in, and then they got all worried about how, you know, it would be criticized for not having such a high standard.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one of the things about Mundelein that was wonderful, but it was always in tension, because there was always a desperate situation. There was never enough money.
Mm-hmm.
And because we were very, we had to be very attentive to our students and to the larger culture around us in order to get students.
Mm-hmm.
So we were very attuned to our environment and very creative.
Mm-hmm.
But because we had no possibility of having, of being measured by money or by, you know, some other sort of formalized standard, we had to measure our quality from within. We had to know that the standard we set was valid and that we could adhere to it. And that it wasn't like somebody else was going to tell us whether we were doing the right thing or not. We had to know. We had to justify it to ourselves. And we also had to justify it to North Central and all the places that you have to explain,
yeah.
You know, this is
right.
What you're doing. It's not just you imagine it, but you set the standard and you show how the standard is met and you show how you guarantee that you follow it. But, you know, we were really risk takers. We had a strong sense of quality because of our own sense of integrity, not because other people said, you know, oh, you're doing the right thing. And that is one of the things I find very different at Loyola. Everything at Loyola is, we don't know whether it's good until
somebody
else
tells
us
it out from the outside, yeah.
No, and no sense of risk, no mm-hmm. sense of how we take the risk. We do the adventure. We try the new thing. Oh, it's all wait and see, wait and see, wait and see.
Do you think that part of that is size, or is it just a completely different culture?
I think it's a totally different risk-averse, hierarchical, you know, very, what is in a sort of negative sense, bourgeois sense of, you know, we have to conform, and we can't, we don't know whether we're doing the right thing until we're told that, that we're okay.
So that's probably one of the most things you miss most about Mundelein.
It absolutely is. Yeah. It absolutely is. There is no sort of inner sense of that of the cause that's worth the risk and that is going to be done well. I mean, actually, when you think now of the language, it's very entrepreneurial. And Loyola keeps trying to get people to be entrepreneurial, and I think, yeah, but it's just not an entrepreneurial environment. Anybody that has a good idea that is at all not already proved somewhere else is, like, not listened to. And certainly not supported or funded, you know.
In terms of the students and the mission of Mundelein to educating women, do you think that that has carried over in any way? Or is it no?
Actually, you know, one of the things that happened that people do tell me about Loyola, I notice the, you know, the loss.
Okay.
But other people who have seen that. Now, in the history department, we had three Mundelein faculty. Well, really four, because Sister Joan Francis taught for quite a while, too, before she retired. And three of us came to the history department. So that was a big number. And, of course, we had different views of teaching and of relating to students. And so I've had history colleagues say we were a notable difference. I mean, the way we talked in meetings, the kinds of issues we thought everybody should talk about was shocking. Even though we didn't know we were being shocking,
right.
You know, we just thought, isn't this what we do? And then they would all be like, oh, well, no. And we'd be like, well, don't you think we should do it? You know, and, they,
yeah.
And they, so now I think we mostly were beaten down. You know, basically, the waters closed over us after a short time. But other people seem to think that we did make a difference and that things are more open and, you know, there's more possibility. And also, certainly we all came with a commitment to women's studies and or women's history. Maybe mine was probably the most well-developed, but that also made a difference in terms of the sense of what history's about and how to do it. And so that was a huge influx in people who were committed to women's history. So in that world, you know, I would say yes. And then we also had very different ideas about teaching. And one of the things that they said at Loyola was that, you know, they have the Loyola University Center for Instructional Design. And in the transition, we were, of course, all did the orientation as new faculty, so we were told about all the departments and programs and how the university worked. And we were told about this Center for Instructional Design. And they commented on how, you know, they every year they would tell Loyola faculty about this. And, you know, occasionally somebody would ask for help with slides or something. Well, they were inundated. Practically every faculty member from Mundelein was calling up the Center for Instructional Design saying, you know, what can we do? We want, you know, we're interested in this and that. So they suddenly had all these inquiries about how could they help and, you know, interest in teaching in the classroom. And also, we, of course, had worked very hard at Mundelein to develop discussions. And it sort of transferred from the weekend where you had to work with adults. Back into the day program, where once you saw you should do that with adults, it was like, well, we should have these young people talking too. So it, at least in my case, it sort of went back into the day program from working with adults. And when I went to Loyola, it was like, you know, there. And I, of course, was never satisfied with how much discussion or the quality of discussion. It was always never quite reached what we wanted, and we were always struggling. Well, when I went to Loyola, I thought, my goodness, we had achieved such a high standard at Mundelein. It was back to square one, you know, and there's no culture of discussion of the sense that students are responsible for their own learning, that, you know. So, and that's still hard, even though, you know, there are a lot of good teachers at Loyola, but it's still very much lecture. Lecture. We will tell you what you need to know, that engagement, and, you know. So I feel that, well, I think Carolyn Farrell, in which this establishment of the Gannon Center for Women in Leadership, which was not part of the affiliation agreement, the conference, the annual conference on women was part of it, and that the name Mundelein should be attached to the adult part-time program at Loyola. But an actual center for women didn't exist at Loyola except in terms of the Women's Studies program, which had never been able to get a women's center established at Loyola. So Carolyn's insight that if indeed the traditions of Mundelein in supporting women in leadership were going to be preserved, it needed to have a presence, a physical presence and a programmatic presence. So she immediately identified this, and then, you know, politically through getting the support of Anita and his friend from the DeVry Institute, and getting Loyola then to establish this around the Women in Leadership Archives, so that the Mundelein Archives were the foundation for the Women in Leadership Archives, and then the center was kind of necessary to the Women's Conference. And that is the only place I see where a real commitment to what Mundelein was about exists. So in that sense, her insight and her political skill in getting that center established with the archives is what enables that. But that was not, I mean, that was done, yes, with Loyola's support, but not with any insight from them about how it should happen or it was valuable. It was always tolerance. And that's sort of my experience of Loyola. It's, you know, that, and this was an interesting thing about the transition. We were very well received in the history department. Maybe the best experience of anybody in the transition. We were all very well qualified, but we were also very, we were accepted with a great sense of equality.
Now, when Loyola and Mundelein merged or became affiliated, you had already left the order of BBM?
Yes, I left the order in 1980.
Okay.
And the affiliation came in 1991.
Now,
so I had, but, you know, at that point, well, I was certainly not the first. In fact, I was sort of late in the process of people who had left. And so there was no, you know, tension or animosity. And I had tenure as a faculty member, so my status as a member of the community didn't affect that.
Okay.
So I just continued in my work, but I was now not a...
Okay. How were BVMs in general then accepted into the Loyola community?
I don't know the details on that. My sense, as someone who is not a BVM, is that one of the ways that the Jesuits saw the affiliation and attempted to create a sense of commonality was between the Jesuits and the BVMs.
Okay.
And I, you know, the BVMs could speak for themselves on this. That was acceptable, that was appreciated. But the BVMs were somewhat more aware of the fact that they were being selected, and they, it was kind of like they saw themselves as part of the Mundelein faculty, but it was only the women religious who were really courted by the Jesuits.
Okay.
You know, so yeah. it was kind of, you know, the religious orders, which had a certain legitimacy, but of course the BBMs had never, they had seen themselves as not distinct from the enterprise of Lemoyne.
Okay.
They had, although even there we talked about the fact that, well, you know, because they contributed their salaries and that there were differences, whether their perception of the life of faculty members who weren't members of the religious community was as realistic as it might have been, like, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So there were awarenesses of that. But the Jesuits, basically, that was the only group. I would say that probably that, if not the Jesuits, the Loyola administration absolutely did not encourage Lemoyne faculty to maintain their bonds.
Oh, okay.
And they really wanted you to become part of the Loyola faculty in the departments. They didn't want that sense of cohesiveness to be maintained. And that worked.
Okay. I'm going to switch this.